This is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, "Gosh, he's so persistent." Developer Roger Perry has now turned his attention to Raleigh, and he talks about secession plan. And that's the headline on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. The article begins inside with a second headline, "A Touch for Tough Projects." From Meadowmont and beyond, Roger Perry's keen eye has defined the region. And this article is written by Amanda Hoyle. In the produce section, or sometimes the meat department at the Harris Teeter Grocery at Meadowmont in Chapel Hill, developer and Meadowmont resident Roger Perry often runs into old foes who stood united against the project for a long time. Today, many of them are friends. "I don't ever say, 'I told you so,' but I do occasionally have a smug look on my face," he chuckles. Perry, the affable millionaire businessman, has spent much of the past 35 years seeking the town's permission to build some of its most polarizing projects, such as Meadowmont, with its 1,100 closely clustered homes and village center. Some Chapel Hillians called his ideas crass or too big and accused him of trying to turn Chapel Hill into Perryville. But Meadowmont's launch in 1999 and then his six-story East 54 development in Chapel Hill became two of the more decorated communities in the region for their design and functionality, serving as a model for mixed-use development across the area. Perry grew up in a middle-class family in Spring Lake near Fort Bragg and still carries a stocky stature dating from his days as a high school athlete. He graduated from UNC Chapel Hill in 1971 and circled back to his college town to launch a career that forged many of the Triangle's signature projects. His keen sense of the emerging Triangle market and his ability to find compromise helped him rise to chairman of the school's Board of Trustees in 2007. And now, at 67, he is gently pulling back from some of his business interests and letting a young group of leaders at East West Partners put their stamp on the future of the Triangle, while they, as he always has, take on projects with real risk and real potential. Perry had not returned to Chapel Hill in the mid-1980s to pick a fight with his college town, but it did help him develop a thick skin for local politics and tough projects. Chapel Hill is not known for being kind to developers, often dragging an approvals process over the course of several years if a plan doesn't fit exactly with the neighborhoods around it. Meadowmont, a former family farm on the east side of town, took 9 years. Approvals for Obey Creek, a 1.6 million square foot mixed-use project on the south side of town that hasn't even broken ground yet, took 6 years. Chapel Hill's process has scared off developers unwilling to risk the time and money it takes to get a project through the entitlement process. In recent years, however, Chapel Hill has made that process easier. For example, it introduced a form-based code for the Ephesus Fordham Zoning District that gives property owners a clear vision of what is allowed. Perry's company, East West Partners, was the first to test it with Village Plaza, a 90-foot-tall apartment, retail, and parking building that is scheduled to be completed in March. "Roger will probably tell you that it's helped weed out a lot of bad projects," says former Chapel Hill Mayor Kevin Foy. "He's cognizant of how developers are viewed with skepticism around here, but he doesn't shy away from it." Making a mark in the Triangle. Perry and East West Partners have been at the center of some of the Triangle's signature developments the last four decades, most recently at the Liberty Warehouse Apartments project, rising in downtown Durham. East West also has showed interest in redeveloping the old Rex Hospital land on Wade Avenue in Raleigh. For most of those 40 years, East West Partners, almost always a company of only 8 to 10 employees, was a land development specialist, building streets, lots, and clubhouses for home builders and residents at Woodcroft in Durham, Falls River in Raleigh, and Cary Park in Cary, plus projects in Charlotte, Greensboro, and Huari Point. Altogether, East West has helped build nearly 15,000 homes, condos, and apartment units, plus retail and commercial centers across the state, valued at close to $4 billion. But as the Triangle grew and available land became more scarce, Perry's attitude and business model shifted. I decided about 10 years ago now that I was losing touch with the market. I was aging out of the mainstream, Perry confesses. I saw the way real estate was transacting, what people were buying, what they were looking for, how they were doing it, and what they were asking for is not the way I was accustomed to it. So we hired Bryson, then Lee, then Ben. It's his way of saying he's passing the torch to the next generation of East-West Partners, a trio that includes Perry's sons, Lee Perry, 39, Ben Perry, 35, and 15-year East-West Partners veteran, Bryson Powell, 36. They are ambitious and hungry, and they all have three children, so they have hungry mouths to feed, and they're very aggressive and work very hard, Roger Perry says. It's kept our company vital. They are all now partners in the company, along with Dennis Rochelle, the chief financial and operating officer, who has been with Perry for 26 years. Changing approach. For years, most of East-West Partners' land deals were structured using money from friends and family, sometimes through partnerships with old friends or connections made through Perry's heavy involvement raising money and leading committees for his alma mater at UNC Chapel Hill. But in recent years, most of the company's commercial heavy projects have been financed using more out-of-state equity capital. In Durham, Powell took the lead on the $55.1 million redevelopment of the old Liberty Warehouse property on Foster Street, Durham's last tobacco auction house. It has been rebuilt as a 250-unit apartment, retail, and parking structure. The project was financed using a $35 million construction loan from Fifth Third Bank, plus $15 million in equity capital from Washington, D.C.-based Northridge Capital LLC, and another $5.1 million from East-West Partners, and a silent partner that neither the Perrys nor Powell would disclose. At the firm's $50 million Village Plaza apartment and retail project in Chapel Hill, a 50-50 joint venture with Trammell Crowe Residential, opportunistic real estate investor Markel Eagle of Glen Allen, Virginia, contributed $15 million to get it started. Both apartment buildings, sources say, are likely to be sold to new investors for a sizable profit before the end of the year. All of our profits are success-based, and a lot of people have got to get paid before we do, Ben Perry says. East-West Partners is also involved in a $75 million public-private partnership deal in Wilmington, its first project at the coast, to build a 12-story condominium apartment, retail, and parking structure near the banks of the Cape Fear River in downtown. Lee Perry says they should be ready to break ground in the summer. The Wilmington project, like so many for East-West Partners, is one with some real risk and potential reward. For better or for worse, we seem to always find the deals that have just enough hair that nobody else kind of looks at them, but we think it's interesting and unique, Powell says. Lessons from the Great Recession. But with the hair comes also greater risk for failure. Before the Great Recession, Roger Perry would have told you his company and most of its projects were recession-proof. He had learned some hard lessons in the 1980s when the 2,600-home Adams Farm community he was building in Greensboro nearly went bankrupt. It was my second project. I was coming off of Woodcroft, which was the home run of all home runs, and I thought we had special powers, he says. I thought Woodcroft was a huge success because of us. It wasn't. Woodcroft was in the path of an enormously fast-moving freight train, and we didn't have the gumption to know that just 50 miles away, the way business is done and the products that are popular and sell are totally different than they are here. Perry worked out a deal with his lender at Adams Farm and finished the community, but his projects from then on were financed more conservatively, with his preferred debt-to-equity ratio model of 75 to 80% debt to 20 to 25% equity at a time when many other development firms were satisfied with a 90-10 debt-to-equity ratio. Then the 2008 recession ripped the carpet out from underneath just about every real estate project in the country. East-West Partners managed to stay ahead of most of its deals when the recession hit, Perry says, with the exception of Davis Park, a residential townhouse and condominium project that was already underway near Research Triangle Park. The project's bank lender stopped funding the loan, and the sold-out project took additional hits when many of its buyers forfeited deposits averaging $5,000 and walked away. To protect against similar losses at the more expensive $100 million East 54 project in Chapel Hill that opened in 2010, Perry shifted his equity requirements to 35% to 40% and required a 10% non-refundable deposit from all condo buyers, equating to an average of $40,000 to $50,000 for each unit. Not as many people walked away from that, he says. I thought we were pretty conservative before, and I would have told you that was sufficient for a recession, but it wasn't for that recession. Foy says Perry seems to have mastered the give and take required to make a real estate project a success, even in a town like Chapel Hill. He's still a businessman, and the numbers have to work, but one thing about Roger is that he's willing to negotiate, he says. When other developers were telling us we were being unreasonable in our demands for affordable housing requirements, Roger figured out a way to make it work. He never took the position that it was unreasonable. He embraced it, and he used his expertise to make our programs better. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings. The main headline, longtime Raleigh florist to remain on P Street. Fallon's Flowers, the longtime florist in Raleigh, next to Broughton High School, was chaotic as usual on Valentine's Day, and it turns out it's going to be that way for a while. Raleigh's Walton family put the 9,100-square-foot building up for sale, asking a shade under $3 million for the property. That obviously led to questions about whether Fallon's, which started on Fayetteville Street in 1920 and moved to the corner of St. Mary's and Peace in 1951, would be pushed out. Turns out the florists are no shrinking violets. Fallon's general manager, Frank Campisi, tells Biz that the Georgia family, which owns Fallon's, bought the building for the asking price. Campisi says Brian and Aaron McCarthy of Alpharetta, Georgia, owned 32 flower shops, including the three Fallon's in North Carolina. Campisi says the McCarthys should close on the building in about 2 weeks, and Campisi says the building will change. There are definitely going to be some renovations done to this, he says. That means a long tradition in Raleigh will continue, where the downtown Fallon's cranks out 50,000 roses over the Valentine's week. Fallon's also does about 1,800 deliveries, Campisi says. Teen creates buzz with her nut butter sales. Business is booming for a 17-year-old from the Charlotte area who wanted to make a healthier peanut butter and decided to do it herself. Abby Kircher of Mooresville felt she was overweight 2 years ago but didn't want to give up peanut butter, so she was looking for healthier alternatives. She tried almond butter but says, the regular almond butters didn't appeal to my taste. So she made her own, and friends raved about it. My mom and I started thinking, why don't we start a new business? So they did, in October 2015. Now the product, Abby's Better Nut Butters, has grown so much, Kirchner says she and her family are making 2,000 jars per week. The product is in stores in Charlotte, New York City, Tennessee, South Carolina, and now the Triangle. Kircher says the product is in some Lowe's grocery stores and will soon make the shelves of Whole Foods in the Triangle area. It's been quite a learning experience, she says, of starting a business. New president has the spirit for the job. The North Carolina Spirits Association has recently named Mark Mullins of Social House Vodka as its new president. Mullins, who is the co-founder and senior vice president of sales and marketing at Social House Vodka, has more than a decade of experience in the business. Prior to his current stint, Mullins served as vice president and general manager of North American Spirits and Wine Brokers of North Carolina, Alabama, and Mississippi. Mark's background serves as an excellent foundation to represent all stakeholders in the distilled spirits industry, while growing the community of support throughout North Carolina, said Rick Stadler, chairman of the board of directors of the North Carolina Spirits Association. Biotech execs pitch ideas on air with Captain Kirk. Execs at a Mooresville biotech scored some unique recognition this month, making an appearance on Moving America Forward, which airs on Biz TV. Anutra Medical founder Daniel Davidian, CEO Cameron Perkins, and Vice President of Marketing Ryan Vett were interviewed by William Shatner and Doug Llewellyn in a Los Angeles studio. They discussed Anutra's local anesthetic delivery system. Mr. Shatner, the first step in keeping America healthy is getting people to visit the doctor or dentist. One of the worst parts about visiting the doctor or dentist is the shot, Davidian said during the interview. North Hills won't be home for MLS bid. Speculation following Raleigh developer John Kane's purchase of a 20-acre tract of land on St. Albans Drive next to his North Hills development in Midtown Raleigh has been fueling lots of talk about what's going to be built on the land. Retail, apartments, office, soccer stadium. Kane and North Carolina Football Club owner Steve Malik have been friends for years, and with Malik's recent bid to bring a Major League Soccer team to the Triangle, there's been a lot of chatter about where a new 22,000-seat stadium could be built. But it won't be North Hills. I defer to Steve Malik on all soccer stadium questions, but there is not a location at North Hills that could accommodate a stadium, he says. Relias Leader takes turn answering customer calls. If you called Relias Learning's client support line February 15, CEO Jim Triandaflu may have answered your query. Relias recently started a program that has senior executives work the company's phone lines a couple of times per year, according to Candace Wallace, Director of Support Services. The simplest issue was that someone needed their password reset, says Triandaflu. Of the experience, Triandaflu says, having executives on the phone and seeing our support team in action is an example of our thirst for learning. As for the company's 2016 performance, Relias said it saw revenue growth of 42% year over year. Triandaflu attributed the success to the company's client focus and entrance into new markets, including hospitals, as well as continued growth in online learning. That's a great year for us, Triandaflu says. But it all starts with happy clients. And now we turn to the On Retail Real Estate page, written by Amanda Hoyle. The first headline, Wild Ride Coming in Housing Market. With indications that mortgage interest rates will start a steady uptick through 2017, buyers in the Triangle who might have been waiting to upsize or move within the region are starting to take action, says John Wood, owner of RE/MAX United in Cary. The spring market for 2017 will be a wild ride for those buyers looking to buy below $400,000, and they need to be prepared to make decisions quickly and to expect to be in multiple offer situations on a regular basis, Wood says. The inventory of Triangle Homes dropped 16% to 7,206 listings in January, or about 2.3 months' supply of inventory. On average, a Triangle home was on the market 54 days until sale, down from an average 66 days until sale in January 2016, according to Triangle Multiple Listing Service. Home sales that were still pending in January were also up about 10% over year prior, Wood says. I also believe the crazy multi-offer market we saw throughout 2016 is making the market numbers grow during the traditional slower winter season, Wood says. Buyers are expanding their time frame to move in order to find the right home. When new listings come on the market, we are seeing strong showings right away, and if it's priced correctly, we are seeing quick sales. Wood says buyers should get pre-approved for their mortgage and be prepared to present a strong offer. Bargain Hunter buys empty Durham Walmart for far below listed price. Opportunistic Raleigh real estate investor David Urban has swooped in and purchased the Walmart store building vacated a year ago on Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Durham for a lowball $2.5 million. The 109,000-square-foot Durham property, built in 2011, had previously been listed for sale for $6 million. The store closed in January 2016 as part of a culling of 154 locations across the U.S. Urban, representing the buyer, TOL LLC, says his group sees the acquisition as an excellent opportunity to offer to a tenant or tenants an almost brand new building on 13 acres at below market lease rates. The property was bought on a speculative basis with no future retail tenant or new use confirmed. The Dilwag Companies of Durham is providing loan financing for the project. Ward & Smith moving to new $22 million Highwoods building. Highwoods Properties has announced it will be breaking ground in the fall on a $21.9 million three-story office building at the Raleigh Corporate Center after striking a deal with the Raleigh Law Office of Warden Smith. The firm will take a full floor of the 90,000-square-foot building in West Raleigh, relocating from Wade Office Park. Our ability to design it from the ground up will allow us to plan for maximum efficiency and keeps us on one floor, says co-managing director Ken Wooten. Warden Smith's new top floor space will accommodate 50 attorneys and 50 support staff as the firm expects to continue to grow. Construction will begin in the third quarter with completion in late 2018. Renovations at downtown's Sheraton Raleigh are complete. It took two ownership groups and close to 3 years, but renovations to the 35-year-old Sheraton Raleigh Hotel at 421 South Salisbury Street in downtown Raleigh are finally complete. The management company for the Sheraton, one of Raleigh's largest hotels, confirms it has completed the multi-million-dollar renovation to the 353-room hotel, which included a complete refurbishment of all guest rooms, corridors, fitness center, and club lounge. Buccini Poland had acquired the hotel from Connecticut-based Northview Hotel Group, which had bought the property in 2012. Northview had completed a $5.5 million renovation of the hotel in 2014 that included the addition of a Jimmy V's Osteria and Bar restaurant and all new furniture, floors, and design for its lobby, lounge, and meeting spaces. And finally, in a section called He Said It, the quote, "That's an historical number. You can see the trend line because all the new construction is costing more. The locations are costing more. The design is costing more. And the rent is going to cost more." And that's from John Linderman, managing partner of Avis & Young, at his company's annual commercial real estate forecast event February 8, speaking about the rise of Class A office rental rates in the Triangle, which averaged $25.86 per square foot in 2016. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Tech and Transportation page written by Lauren Onisorge. The main headline, Ting details Holly Springs rollout. As Google Fiber, AT&T, and other internet service providers are starting to realize, getting gigabit speeds is an intense and expensive endeavor. That's why they've targeted their residential fiber launches to specific areas, leaving some gaps in the process. A company filling one of those gaps is Ting Mobile, which has been connecting fiber customers in Holly Springs for about a month. Because it is a limited deployment, it provides insight into how the math works when it comes to implementing high-speed connections. On a recent earnings call, Elliot Noss, CEO of Ting's Canadian parent, Tucows, told analysts, Ting expects a 20% adoption rate among its serviceable addresses in a year and 50% in 5 years. At these take rates, we'll be paying about $2,500 to $3,000 per customer in capital expenditure, and those customers will be worth about $1,000 a year in margin, he says, adding that pre-orders are guiding the build-out in Holly Springs. Ting is one of a handful of companies building connections in metros Google Fiber left out of its grand plans for the Triangle. Google, which started connecting customers in Raleigh earlier this month, is limiting its service to Raleigh, Durham, Mooresville, Chapel Hill, Cary, Carrboro, and Garner, the company has said. AT&T, which debuted its own high-speed service more than a year before Google Fiber, has extended its service further. But AT&T, unlike Google, doesn't make announcements until the service is actually connecting customers, meaning its rollout plans aren't yet clear. More than 2 years after officials in Holly Springs, Wake Forest, and Apex expressed frustration at being left out of Google Fiber's plans, Triangle Business Journal checked to see how fiber efforts were going. Holly Springs, Ting began signing up customers in January and is expanding its service. Apex, town manager Drew Haven says Apex, thanks to AT&T, now has fiber in some areas, and AT&T has said it plans to continue to expand its fiber footprint across the Triangle. Wake Forest, Thomas LaBarge, IT director for the town, says that while the metro currently just has legacy providers offering limited fiber, CenturyLink, Spectrum, it continues to explore its options. The commission The commissioners recently viewed a consultant's presentation on fiber feasibility. Wind farms could grow in North Carolina. As the massive wind farm near Elizabeth City comes online, the developer behind the $400 million 104-turbine project is looking ahead to further investments in North Carolina. Years of litigation, community rallying, and complex construction came to fruition February 9 when wind farm developer Avangrid announced that the wind farm was operating at full power, providing wind energy to Seattle e-retailer Amazon. Jesse Groner, the Portland, Oregon-based vice president of development at Avangrid, says more may be in the works for North Carolina. He says the company is actively looking to expand the site by 30 to 50 turbines, resulting in an additional 100 megawatts of power. The turbines currently have 2-megawatt capacity, but already Avangrid is using 2 to 3.5-megawatt equipment, meaning that higher megawatt-capable turbines could lessen future silo count. Groner says his team is analyzing other opportunities in the state. We're hoping to continue in the area of where we just built, as well as more broadly finding other parts of the state where there are opportunities for wind and for solar, he says. Avangrid isn't deterred by a letter Republican leaders in Raleigh sent to the Trump administration. In that letter, some legislators expressed concern over a wind project's possible impact to military operations, something that Avangrid and others have refuted. If we have a strong partnership with the local community, if we have a dedicated buyer like Amazon, who wants to see and utilize clean, affordable power, then we're going to be able to do deals, he says. And also with this article, there's a section called By the Numbers. The Amazon farm will generate 208 megawatts of electricity each year, enough to power more than 61,000 homes. And finally, in the section called He Said It, a couple of quote sections. The first one, it's as you could imagine, relatively easy to eliminate qualified prospects from the pipeline as we focused on more higher quality customers. We need to be doing more to drive more of that into the top of the funnel and to close them. That's from David Spitz, Channel Advisor CEO, said in a recent earnings call. The company is embarking on a transformation, focusing on larger customers, but it's taking a long time to see results, and the stock dove more than 20% after its fourth quarter earnings report this month. And in a section called They Said It, we need more STEM skills. Every industry is moving in that direction. There's a huge need for data scientists. That's Jim Goodnight, CEO of SAS Institute. Without reading proficiency, too many children will enter elementary school already lagging behind. That's from Vanessa Harrison, president of AT&T North Carolina. And we need to have data, relevant data, and the system needs to be collected, managed, and analyzed. That data needs to talk to each other, and that's not happening today. That's from Jim Whitehurst, CEO of Red Hat. And now we turn to the Life Sciences page written by Jennifer Henderson. The main headline, Duke Wake Med to collaborate. Hospitals facing new competition to work together. Duke Health and Wake Med Health and Hospitals have inked an operating agreement to collaborate on cardiovascular care, the organizations announced February 14. The organizations are also in talks to develop a cancer service collaboration. While a collaboration focused on rehabilitation is in earlier stages as well, according to Dr. William Fulkerson, Jr., Executive Vice President of Duke University Health System, and Donald Gintzig, President and CEO of Wake Med. Integration is slated to begin March 1, according to the organizations. It comes as UNC Rex is scheduled to open its 8-story, 114-bed North Carolina Heart and Vascular Hospital the same month. But there is no merger between Duke Health and Wake Med in the works, the organizations insist. In terms of the cardiovascular collaboration, the financial results will be shared between the two organizations according to the formal operating agreement, the terms of which are confidential, says Fulkerson. The collaboration will involve a clinical committee of physicians, an operating committee of administrators, and a board, as well as consensus between the two organizations, he adds. We'll operate as a single service line, says Fulkerson. The collaboration will enable greater access to clinical trials, as well as opportunities to improve efficiencies in terms of the delivery of care. Both Fulkerson and Gintzig say Duke Health and WakeMed had some collaboration in pediatric care prior to their original plans to collaborate more formally announced back in 2014. It's important for organizations and healthcare providers to look at ways to collaborate, says Gintzig, noting the end goal is providing patients the right care at the right time and at affordable costs. At the same time, competition is important as well, he says. The new collaboration aims to achieve those objectives through expanded capabilities minus the cost of new infrastructure, according to Gintzig. New effort at UNC Rex seeks to manage patients with behavioral issues in ER. UNC Rex Healthcare has plans for a new space for patients with behavioral health issues after receiving a $2.5 million donation from an anonymous donor. The new space will serve as a holding area for behavioral health patients at the emergency department for treatment, UNC Rex announced, and will include 8 private rooms. Managing patients in the emergency rooms, especially those with mental health concerns, has been a rising problem for emergency rooms. UNC Rex has been discussing and planning this space for several years as the volume of behavioral health patients continues to rise, said UNC Rex spokesman Alan Wolf in an email. Last fall, the anonymous donor approached us about a gift that would help accelerate the design and construction. UNC Rex had 1,400 behavioral health patients in the emergency room in 2016 and expects 1,600 this year. Space will open up when the NC Heart and Vascular Hospital opens in March. Campbell Community Law Clinic awarded new grant. Campbell Law School's Community Law Clinic, which launched in April, has been awarded a $10,000 grant from the North Carolina Bar Association Foundation. The school said the grant will supplement the clinic's operational budget. The clinic, which offers pro bono legal services to community members who are facing challenges in areas such as housing and employment, was originally funded by a $150,000 grant from the Z. Smith Reynolds Foundation. New app seeks to help clinical trials. Parexel International Corporation has launched a mobile app that will use barcode technology to cut down on human errors in clinical trials. The app is for the ClinPhone RTSM, Randomization and Trial Supply Management service, which has been deployed on over 3,700 studies and more than 2.5 million patients, according to Parexel. The app will enable those involved in clinical trials, including investigators, nurses, and research associates, to more efficiently handle tasks, including allocating treatment and dispensing medicine, the company said. Clinical trials management is often hampered by administrative supply-related tasks at site locations, said Ken Faulkner, corporate vice president of Parexel Informatics. Simplifying systems and processes and removing manual data entry can save staff time and increase patient safety. And finally, in a section called He Said It, at the Institute for Emerging Issues at NC State University's annual forum called Kidonomics, the Economics of Early Childhood Investment, the quote, economists say that high-quality early education is a great economic investment and is one of the best things a state can do to build its economy and provide more high-paying jobs for its citizens. And that's from Jim Hunt, former North Carolina governor, chair emeritus, IEA National Advisory Board. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page, where first we read a column written by Lee Hamilton, who is a distinguished scholar at Indiana University School of Global and International Studies and was a member of the U.S. House of Representatives for 34 years. The headline on his Viewpoint column, Our Need for a Free Press. If you watched a recent Donald Trump press conference, you may have overlooked a telling and worrisome moment. A CNN reporter tried to ask him about the extent of his ties to Russian officials. "No, not you, no, your organization is terrible," responded Trump and moved on to the next question. The fact that a politician would seek to sidestep an uncomfortable question isn't unusual. What should cause concern is what happened next. Nothing. The press corps moved on, without protesting or taking up CNN's line of questioning and pushing for an answer. Why do I find this disquieting? Because journalists play a crucial role in our representative democracy's health. Though power may seem to rest in Washington, state capitals, and city halls around the nation, in the end it is wielded by citizens who have the ability to seat and unseat elected officials, to organize around issues, and, through concerted action, to affect the policy agenda. But citizens cannot act responsibly if they're kept in the dark, and it's the media's role to make sure that does not happen. Its performance in recent years, however, has not been reassuring. Before the election, how much were you reading or seeing about the depth and intensity of the frustrations in large swaths of the country that enabled Trump's victory? How much coverage do you see about climate change or poverty or the impact on our communities and individuals of the income inequality that has become a hallmark of this era? Sure, there's plenty of news coverage of politics, but it's just that. Coverage of politics, polls, personalities, and campaigns, and much less on the substance of policy issues or what's at stake for the U.S. as they're debated. Last year, early in the primary season, the CEO of CBS said of Trump's presidential run, "It may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS." He later contended he'd been joking, but somehow, I don't find myself reassured that media corporations today are as committed to serving the public good as they ought to be. This is worrisome, but even worse would be a press that doesn't push on regardless. I want to see media coverage of public affairs that's dogged, skeptical, and aggressive, that investigates actions of government and politicians, that checks facts, calls candidates and office holders to account, and flags misstatements, half-truths, and outright lies. Democracy works only with accountability and is strengthened by strict accountability of elected and appointed officials to the people of the country. Without citizens insisting on it and the media demanding it, our system of representative government is in peril. And also on the Viewpoint page, there's a column written by Russ Brinson, who is an attorney at Horick Talley in Charlotte. The headline on his column, "Will the Overtime Final Rule Be Final?" You might have heard that last May, the U.S. Department of Labor passed a new overtime law called the Overtime Final Rule. Under the new law, over 4 million previously exempt employees would be required to be paid overtime based on their current salaries and hours worked. The law was intended to go into effect December 1, but in November, Judge Amos Mazant in the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Texas granted an injunction, preventing the rule from being implemented and enforced. The Labor Department has appealed that decision, and of course, under the new Trump administration, the law could change or disappear. If you're an employer, here's what you need to know. The entire final rule can be found at www.dol.gov. But the primary change is a rise in the salary threshold for exempt employees from $23,660 per year to $47,476. The increase is based on the 40th percentile of earnings of full-time salaried workers in the lowest wage census region, currently the South, according to the DOL's Department of Labor's website. To be exempt from overtime pay, an employee must receive a salary higher than the threshold, i.e. higher than $47,476, and have executive, administrative, or professional duties. Along with increasing the salary threshold, the new law says the salary level must be adjusted every 3 years to that 40th percentile. Most employers implemented changes prior to December 1 to comply with the final rule. Adding employees, raising and restructuring salaries, tracking time more closely, and reducing hours have been common reactions to the law. The final rule forced employers to make difficult decisions regarding how to structure pay and workload. Now, all employers must wait to see what will become of the final rule. What does the injunction mean? What will the Trump administration do about the overtime final rule? At this point, nothing is certain. Below are some possible scenarios. 1. The Trump administration could completely repeal the overtime rules. This is the most likely scenario, as many Republicans are in favor of this option and are pushing for repealing the final rule. During Trump's campaign, he routinely stated he wants to reduce regulations on businesses. Because of the timing of the injunction and the effective date of the final rule, this is a likely starting point for the administration. 2. Other changes could include a small business exemption or a reduction in the salary threshold. The final rule has no small business exemption. Small businesses are likely to feel the biggest impact from the final rule, as they have employees with multiple roles, with more than double the salary required for exempt status. Small businesses would most likely be forced to restructure salary or add employees rather than just increase salaries. As an alternative to repealing the final rule, exempting small businesses or making the salary threshold lower than currently stated in the final rule are possibilities. 3. If the injunction is lifted or overturned, the enforcement date could be retroactive to December 1, 2016, or from a date after the injunction is gone. Employers need to be prepared for this scenario, although it is unlikely. The final rule will not likely be the final rule on overtime laws. Even if the final rule is never implemented, employers need to routinely assess employee responsibilities and monitor their hours. All employers are susceptible to claims regarding overtime pay without documentation or methods of tracking the hours that employees work. If you're an employer, monitor developments on the final rule and pay attention to other proposed revisions in the law. Based on his campaign, Trump may implement more changes affecting employers, such as more documentation required for immigrant workers and possibly for paid maternity leave. And now we turn to the People on the Move page, where the spotlight is on Stuart Hurley, CEO of Structure House. Former Assistant Chief Executive Officer of a 312-bed acute care hospital in Florida, Stuart Hurley has now brought his experience to the Triangle as CEO of Structure House. Structure House is a weight loss treatment facility located in Durham. In his new role, Hurley oversees the day-to-day management and operations of Structure House's residential weight loss facility and wellness center. He also has the primary responsibility for the development and execution of the facility's business plan in conjunction with routine operations and enhancing the quality of its program. Structure House operates under the umbrella of publicly traded Arcadia Healthcare, based in Franklin, Tennessee. The facility is situated on a 12-acre campus in the Bull City and currently employs about 50 people plus 12 contractors. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? No 2 days are ever the same, and our work environment is extremely positive in helping individuals achieve both short and long-term healthy weight loss and lifestyle changes. What are some of your major goals for your position? One of my main goals is to increase awareness for individuals throughout the U.S. and internationally who are looking to achieve healthy weight loss and lifestyle change. I also look forward to completing several large construction projects on our 12-acre campus, including renovation of our luxury apartment accommodations, renovation of our fitness center, and the development of a freestanding wellness spa and culinary demonstration building. Biggest pet peeve? Avoiding single-use plastic water bottles. Biggest worry? Irreversible environmental damage. Triangle area business person you most admire? Jim Whitehurst, CEO of Red Hat. Last book you've read? Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life by William Finnegan. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Around the State section. The first article, headline, Charlotte's South End Adding Walkable Retail, and this is written by Jennifer Thomas. Asana Partners' vision for South End will add walkable retail to the design center of the Carolinas complex. Plans call for up to 100,000 square feet of additional ground floor retail over the next 5 years. That will include a mix of interesting local, regional, and national tenants, says Sam Judd, Chief Investment Officer. Charlotte-based Asana's portfolio is focused on urban and retail infill projects. You've got some opportunities. Charlotte doesn't really have a lot of walkable areas where there's a critical mass of retail, Judd says. Retail and restaurants will be spread across the center's three buildings, known as the Courtyard, Atrium, and Plaza buildings, and 200 West Tremont, which sits adjacent. Asana bought that 4.5-acre parcel, which encompasses an entire block, for just more than $42 million last November. That's Asana's largest investment in Charlotte to date. It also owns Tranquil Court in Myers Park and the Dollar General-anchored shopping center in Elizabeth at the corner of 7th Street and Pecan Avenue. I think Charlotte has got a lot going on, and there's opportunity to improve the retail offerings, Judd says. In South End, light rail access, close proximity of office tenants, and a growing residential market were driving factors in acquiring that development, Judd says. The area along Camden Road also has consistent sidewalks and is nearby to Eden's Atherton Mill, which also will be revamped. It can draw from the whole city, Judd adds. He estimates 20,000 square feet at the design center will be converted to retail opportunities this year as existing leases expire. The first of those tenants, Tex-Mex restaurant Superica, announced it plans to open in the design center next year. Judd says other deals are in the pipeline. New Trump brand Skyon may put a hotel in Charlotte. The Queen City could be an ideal fit for Trump Hotel's latest flag, 17 of which are expected to be built in the U.S. That's according to Eric Trump, who said in a recent New York Times story that mid-sized trendy cities are being considered for Skyon, the lower-cost flag that was announced in September. In the Times story, Trump listed cities such as Charlotte, Austin, and Nashville, Tennessee, as the types of markets that could fit Skyon's model. Skyon will include a 220-room hotel in Dallas. Eric Trump is Executive Vice President of Development and Acquisitions for the Trump Organization. Triad to complete extension at New Century Business Park. Randolph County, in partnership with the City of Asheboro, expects to complete the extension of a road next month that will cut through a 66-acre industrial site called the New Century Business Park in a move that will improve access to the assemblage of land near U.S. 220. Hal Johnson, county manager, said February 13 that the county has been working with the City of Asheboro for years on a project to extend the New Century Drive from its endpoint at the Randolph County Jail to Veterans Loop Road. The $276,000 road extension, whose cost was evenly split between the city and the county, should be completed within the next month, Johnson said. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the small business section, where we read the column written by Edward Marshall. Marshall is an adjunct professor at the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University and managing partner of the Marshall Group, LLC. The headline on his column, Strong Ethics Provide Guidance. We live in uncertain times. There is fear, anxiety, division, chaos, and change. The people who work with us bring this fear and uncertainty into the workplace, hoping that there is some stability and that they can find meaning in what they do. What port is there for our ship in this storm? I believe there is one safe port, and it is in our collective conscience as manifested by the principles and behaviors of ethical leadership. In our workplaces, we can go to that place called shared values and principles, our sense of what is right, what is bedrock. We can remind ourselves that principles are immutable truths and that, like a lighthouse, they can guide our ship into port and safety. In volatile times, we may turn to our formal leadership to help us realize we still stand on solid ground, we still make a difference, and we still matter. Our leaders can be a beacon, reminding us that what we stand for is good and right and true, that discrimination against our fellow workers is wrong and will not be tolerated, that everyone has an equal voice in the affairs of the business, that everyone owns the vision and the future, that in our diversity there is strength, that we are tolerant and our differences of our differences and revel in the creativity that comes when we disagree. Ethical leadership reminds us we are all ethical leaders who have the power to speak up, to support others and to hold people accountable for behavior that does not align with the sacrosanct principles of respect, trust, honor, dignity, integrity, and responsibility. Ethical leadership reminds us no one is above these principles. We live in a time when we need to find our better angels, when we need to create and sustain workplace cultures that empower the human spirit. The wisdom of the ages is, this too shall pass, and when it does, it will be our adherence to our ethics and ethical conduct that will be our testament to the indomitable human spirit. And now in the Triangle Business, we'll turn to the executive voice. This one is concerning David Rupp, who became CEO of Four Oaks Bank in 2015. And there's a box along with the article called A Closer Look. Name, David Rupp. Title, CEO of Four Oaks Bank. Residence, Raleigh. Wife, Lori. First job, janitor at the Torpedo Factory, an art center in Alexandria, Virginia, at age 13. And this is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. If you ask David Rupp, CEO of the $720 million asset Four Oaks Bank, he'll tell you community banks and banks in general have a big problem. How do we find that next group of bank leaders, he says. It's something we're thinking about strategically all the time. Rupp, 53, says he has a bit of a run left, but he points to executives across the industry in their late 50s and 60s. We've got to find that group in their 30s who want to make banking their career, he says. It's not just about posting open jobs when recruiting millennials, he says. It's a whole other kettle of fish. What we have to do is prove that we get it, he says. Banks have to prove that they can keep up with technology, that they're not stodgy, that we're here to help, that it's a fun place to work. But how do you prove you're not stodgy when you're 105 years old? That's what Rupp tackles every day. He's working to mesh technology into the Four Oaks-based bank, as well as to further ingrain his bankers in the community that has supported the institution for decades. Recruiting bankers can be tougher than recruiting customers. If you just say, hey, we're a bank, we do finance, and you talk about the technological aspects, it won't be as interesting to a group that's grown up never not knowing computers, he says. Rupp likes to say when he started, he worked with green bar paper and pencils. In some ways, it's interesting just to look back and see how much that's changed, he says. Rupp says he would be a teacher if he weren't in banking and adds, in fact, I may be a teacher someday after all. But now, he lives and breathes finance. His wife, Lori, is chief accounting officer at Raleigh's First Citizens Bank, and they call Raleigh home. For Rupp, numbers seem to flow through his veins. After graduating from Wake Forest University in the early 1980s, Rupp became a public accountant, crunching numbers from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. He had been auditing small thrifts and banks for Eastern North Carolina at Deloitte and thought the work was very interesting. It was so interesting that 4 years into his career, he went to First Union in Charlotte, the city where he would spend 2 decades and meet his wife. But his biggest professional pride is Four Oaks, the bank he joined in 2014. It's here that, when taking on the CEO role in 2015, then-CEO Aidan Lee told him banking would be, well, different. He said it was about the way Four Oaks behaves in the community and the way we represent ourselves as a bank in the community, Rupp says. Through his decades in banking, the crux of community banking has remained the same, he says. Our basic business is still gathering deposits, he explains. But the delivery mechanisms, the way technology is working to meet the changing expectations of customers, is transforming rapidly. An awful lot of the innovation and entrepreneurship in banking now is happening around technology as opposed to what we used to consider normal de novo startups, Rupp says. An awful lot of the conversation around financial services and how they'll be used and consumed, much of that conversation is around what is going on in technology that we call fintech, that intersection of banking, financial services, and technology. and even legacy institutions such as Four Oaks, with 13 branches and 2 loan production offices, are paying attention. He credits the customer base with keeping the Four Oaks brand relatively unchanged for decades, and he credits technology with keeping the bank relevant. As a 100-year-old community bank, we've got to work hard to keep up to make sure we can satisfy the wishes of our customers about delivery, about security protection, and convenience, Rupp says. Technology helps us do that. Four Oaks remains a branch-based institution, however. The community activities of its personnel, from softball coaching to church groups, are the differentiator when it comes to relationship building, he says. And he predicts we'll see bank startups again, especially in some of the communities that could really use the help of a local financial institution. One of the things I've really enjoyed about Four Oaks is getting to meet so many people and to see the impact of a true community bank on the community, he says, so I hope we will see more startups. Rupp recommends the next class of banking entrepreneurs look to accounting programs to fine-tune their futures. If you have an accounting degree, it really does, I think, give you another way of looking at things, he says, adding that bankers should view their calling as a service business. Banking, like retail, is about customer service, he explains, and future bankers are something he thinks about often. Rupp tries to incorporate new hires into community banking culture, starting with the twice-yearly fish fry Four Oaks hosts in conjunction with community fire departments. His contributions to the fish fries is typically garbage duty, for now. Eventually, maybe they'll put me in front of a fryer, he jokes. And finally, we have the Business Survey Pulse. The question was, should the Affordable Care Act be repealed and replaced? There were 517 responses. 54% said yes. 46% said no. And we're going to stop there as we run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to tune in same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.